All right, so first I'll start by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to come to this very interesting conference. I just narrowed the title when I heard how much time I had, so I will just discuss the case of the iron nictite and chalcogenides. And the work I'll talk about is in the archive, and it was mostly done by zipping in with a little bit of help with Christian Howland and myself. But I'd like to also thank my other collaborators, Hyowan Park, Camila Ron, and Ji-Hoon Shim, who helped me understand this problem of the iron nictites, as well as experimental colleagues, Peng Chen Dai and Dmitry Basov, with whom I've discussed a lot and co-author papers on their experiments. So to sort of set up my talk, I just looked at the website of the workshop and the conference, and I looked at the questions that the workshop is supposed to address. And since there is very little time for a talk, I decided just to give you the main conclusion and the answer to each one of the questions, so that if the chairman cuts me off, then I basically at least you heard what is the main point. Okay, so one question is, with regards to the iron-based materials, the questions include how should we treat systems that are neither weakly or strongly correlated, and how to marry the two extremes. And basically, we have not the full answer, but I think we have a partial answer that works reasonably well, and is dynamic and mean field theory. And we'll show you in the case of iron nictites. And I will interpret this question a little bit broader. It's not just which technical tool you use to do your calculations, but also how do you approach and how do you think about these materials. And I'd like to convince you that the iron nictites and chalcogenides are really new class of strongly correlated electron systems, and that to really understand them, you really need a theory of Hund's metals, which is something that I will define. So then another question is the pairing symmetry universal across all the iron nictites and chalcogenides? And I will say, no, it's not universal. And what we find is that there are actually three almost degenerate states. One is the Kuroki-Mazin S plus minus state that has been discussed a lot. But within the energy resolution we have, there are actually two other candidate superconducting states. One is a D-wave state, and one is a new antiphase S plus minus state that I will discuss with you in the talk. So I think that this at least has a clear answer within mean field theory. Then the question is, what is the role of the orbital degrees of freedom? And is the magnetism associated with quasi-localized moments, or originates from itinerant electrons near the Fermi surface? And the answer is that both actually are very important in this Hund's metal, and that the spin and the orbits have completely different RG flows. The spin splitting is getting weak as you go to low energies, while the orbital splitting is getting strong as you go to low energies. And that's very important for understanding the physics of Hund's metals. And then there has to be an open question. So I took the last question of the workshop as the open question, which is to relate the TC to the local chemistry of the material and to understand how one can enhance the superconducting transition temperature. But I would like to address, even though this is a very open and important question, I would like to address it and show you how now we really have technical tools to actually study materials, build materials which did not exist in the laboratory before. So if I don't get to this, please ask me. Okay, so now let's start from the beginning. Sort of how do we approach materials which are neither itinerant nor localized? And the answer is simple. You don't do perturbation theory neither in the Hoppings nor in the U, but you just take a different starting point. And the starting point in this case is by now an old development, which is dynamic and mean field theory, where the key idea is really to embed an impurity model as a reference system to think about the strongly correlated material. So the impurity model, this local site in a medium, is the way we think about the solid. And that's sort of the embedding. From this embedding, we can actually generate irreducible quantities. We can generate, for example, a local self-energy, or we can generate an irreducible vertex, and we can reconstruct all the k-dependence of the susceptibility or the ARPES. So basically, that's sort of the strategy. We use the quantum impurity model to generate the irreducible quantities, and then we reconstruct all the k-dependence via essentially Dyson equations. So the strategy is very simple, and it gets a little bit more hairy when we go to real materials, because now the Hilbert space of a real solid is much bigger, and now what we need to do is really we need to embed this self-energy in a much bigger Hilbert space, and that's why we have some headaches, because then the orbitals, how precisely we do the embedding, becomes important. And why do we want to do that? Well, it's really interesting for me that each material has a minimal unit. Cuprates has a plaquette, vanadium oxide has a dimer, and for pnictites, it turns out that the single side DMFT works very well, and that gives us access to the bad metal regime. An important thing about these high temperature superconductors is that they all come from metals which at high temperatures are very resistive. And from this single side DMFT, we can actually start from this bad metal regime and try to see how the superconductivity develops. Second, this is not the full solution of the problem. What we really do is do local physics. So we separate the local physics, which we treat very well, from long wavelength fluctuations effects, which then will have to be treated later if it turns out to be important. Third, we really separate the strong correlation problem in two separate parts. One is to study the evolution of one mean field solution, and there are several mean field solutions. And then a second problem is to draw the phase diagram and study the different order states. So if you try to do everything at the same time, and I think that's the problem with most numerical methods, then it's very, very hard to make progress. But by sort of separating them, we can at least understand how a solution evolves, how the superconductivity depends on parameters, how the normal state depends on parameters. So in some sense, you should think of this as a compass in the space of materials. Okay, so now many people always ask me, well, how do you know that this thing works? And in the case of iron nictites and transition metal oxides, we sort of know that the approach is reasonable, in the sense that you can imagine that you're doing perturbation theory in the Green's function and the screen Coulomb interactions, and you evaluate by brute force the diagrams. That's something that we did long ago with Nick Zine and Sergei Savrasov. And what we observed is that when we go to higher order graphs for generic materials, the graphs which have more and more Green's functions, they get more and more local. So the local approximation becomes, not being exactly the critical point or in the vicinity of one, generically for many materials that we studied, we can show by brute force calculation that the local approximation is sensible for higher order graphs. In fact, it's the lower order graphs which are the most non-local. And then recently, for the iron nictites, in collaboration with Mark Mansfield-Gard, we actually evaluated the low-order self-energy, what's called the GW self-energy diagram, and which is a full omega and k-dependent diagram. And we showed that really has this separable form, namely that the frequency-dependent part is essentially local, while the static potential, in fact, has some non-locality beyond LDA. All right, so how well did it do? At the end of the day, the thing that it's the iron nictites, why they were interesting for me, is that they were new materials for which there was very little information, and therefore we could really see how well does the method when we don't know the answer experimentally. After we know the answer experimentally, it's very easy to make a theory and explain all that is seen. But before, it's actually a very, very hard problem. So the early DMFT predictions were the following. First, we evaluated the superconducting coupling and showed that it could not be due to phonons. And second, we estimated that this material was not weakly correlated. In fact, we had mass enhancements of the order of 3 to 5. This is of like vanadium oxide. This is not a weakly correlated material. So we decided that the correlations in this material were actually important. Finally, we notice that if we look at the spectral functions within, say, 0.1 eV window, the Fermi energy, you really need to include all the active d orbitals. So 5 orbitals is the minimum for this problem. The second question that we addressed is, where do these interactions come from? Where do these correlations come from? And here, I think, was the most important surprise in this game, because we observed that these correlations here, for example, have the resistivity for as we vary parameters. That's something that we can do in the model and we cannot do in the experiment. So here we take a fairly large U. U is of the order of 5 or 6 eV, which is bigger than the bandwidth, but instead we vary the Hund's rule J. And then what we found is that no matter that the U was very large, if the J is 0, the resistivity of this material is tiny. And the physical quantities, the resistivity or the specific heat, are very, very sensitive functions of the Hund's rule coupling J. So the origin of the correlations in these materials have nothing to do with Hubbard U physics, have nothing to do with charge blocking, the fact that when you try to move from one side to the other, you have a large U which already blocks the charge motion, but in fact is entirely due to the Hund's rule J. Now, this was done at the very beginning of this game, and people knew that there were large resistivities, that they were above the Mott-Yoffe regal limit, but people thought, well, this is due to disorder. Nobody really took the correlations point of view very seriously. But very, very recently, in a group in Germany of Christoph Meingast took the potassium iron 2 arsenic 2 and managed to make it very, very pure. As pure that the resistivity here is less than 1 microohm centimeter, less than half a microohm centimeter. This is as good as copper or better. But at high temperatures, this resistivity is like 400 microohm centimeters. And you see very, very clearly a crossover at high temperatures from an incoherent metal to a T-square behavior at low temperatures, just like we had predicted very, very early on. Okay, so I think that this idea that these materials are strongly correlated and that the correlations is due not to Hubbard U but to Hund's physics is under reasonable, strong, firm footing. But let me give you now some physical feeling where does this effect comes from. Because we're very used to the Mott mechanism for understanding why materials get correlated, and it's hard to understand why, by virtue of the Hund's rule coupling, you can get mass enhancements which are so large. And here, I think the answers were sort of in the literature, and one is an important paper of Zawadzki and van der Marel, who pointed out that if you have a D6 configuration, in fact, increasing J promotes metallicity. You're used to having J in half-filled shells increase the Mott-Hubbard gap. And this will be true for a D5 configuration. But in D6 configuration, the J has exactly opposite effect. It really merges the Hubbard bands and makes the material very metallic. The second sort of point of thing that you need to know was also known in the context of impurity models. People knew that the Kondo scale as a function of transition metal oxide gets exponentially small as you approach the half-filled shell. And that's an effect that was already in a paper by Schrieffer and by Okada and Yoshida, who noticed that the Kondo scale goes from having a minus 1 over n, where n is the orbital degeneracy here, to n here. So it's an effect of 25 for the D shell in the exponential. So it's not really surprising that we have these very, very tiny energy scales by virtue of the Hund's rule coupling in these kind of systems. So this is sort of the basic qualitative physics. Now, how did we do vis-a-vis experiments? Well, optical spectroscopy can be used to determine the mass. And here was the iron nictide materials. This is the mass enhancement relative to the LDA. And here the mass enhancement is 3 times the mass of the LDA. So the M or M star is 0.3. And that was way within the range that we had estimated early on. So indeed, these materials, from the point of view of experiment, have large mass enhancements. But there are other experimental studies, mainly spectroscopies, X-ray spectroscopies, which all looked for evidence for satellites, as traditionally seen in all correlated oxides, and didn't find anything. So several papers did careful spectroscopic studies, and essentially they concluded that the correlations were weak. But in reality, what they concluded is that there are no clear satellites in the experiment. Now, how does a Hund's metal have satellites? Well, the answer is no. And these are like the density of states from the MFT calculations, both the 3D and the 4P arsenic density of states compared to the LDA. And if you look at the sort of the structure of this, is very, very structureless. And to understand that, it's very useful to concentrate in what I call the valence histogram, which describes the state of an iron atom as a function of time. So we have this local impurity model that gives us a physical picture of the iron nictides, and then it fluctuates between all the many body eigenstates of a single atom. Now, in an oxide, typically this histogram would have only three peaks, and it would be very, very sparse. In the nictides, you have over 500 states, which are very important, and all the valence are occupied, 5, 6, 7, 8, even 4. But you also notice that there are some spikes, which is the enhancement of the states which have a very large spin in the histogram. So the conclusion is that from the point of view of the theory, the iron nictides are extremely itinerant systems. So they're very, very correlated, but at the same time are very, very itinerant. This is not a contradiction. Just there was no theory which can give you before both the itinerancy and this very large degree of correlations. And indeed, there is a mass enhancement. So the density of states here is more narrow than the LDA, but the spectral weight that you lose here is distributed uniformly over 10 EV, so that's not the right spectroscopy to detect this mass enhancement. Okay, how about neutron scattering? There were many neutron scatterings, and the neutron scattering experiments were actually much more consistent with a localized picture than with an itinerant model. I just took, for example, a nice paper by Peng Cheng Dai, which sort of measured the S of Q and omega, and it interpreted in terms of spin waves above and below TNL, even in the very tetragonal phase at high temperatures. However, it has the problem that even in the tetragonal phase, even at very high temperatures, if you want to fit the spin wave dispersion, you need very, very anisotropic J's. So the J along the A axis is totally different than the J along the B axis, even though you are in a tetragonal phase. So again, it looks like a problem with the Hund's rule picture, but we sort of developed a neutron spectroscopy for our DMFT results. This is the experimental results of Peng Cheng Dai's group. And this is the calculation. These are the results of the calculations carried out simply within dynamic and mean field theory for the iron nictide materials with the same parameters which we did the other calculations for the 1-2-2. And all the qualitative features of the theory and the experiment match very, very, very well. Except that in the theory, at high temperatures, the system is tetragonal, and it's very, very itinerant. It's just that those spikes in the histograms, those many body eigenstates, are really enhanced in the spin spectroscopy, and they manage to mimic the S of Q and omega of the system, but in a tetragonal theory without any anisotropy, and with essentially an itinerant picture where we have basically very, very itinerant conduction electrons. So that's basically the comparison of the theory and the experiment. And therefore, again, one can make sense within this Hund's metal picture for the fact that some experiments say that the electron is itinerant and other experiments say that the electron is localized. Okay, so now let's go to the question of the pairing symmetry and what's the role of the orbital degrees of freedom. And I showed you that we have some decent, reasonable control over the particle hole channel. We can actually compute the susceptibility, but what we really would like is to estimate the particle-particle susceptibility. So how to do that? Well, the way we do that is by exploiting the Parquet equations. And again, the key input is one quantity, which is an irreducible vertex that we extract from the impurity model. But now this object now is k-dependent because these Green's functional lines contain the lattice, as I explained at the beginning. Now, what's the role of the orbitals? We have to make a pairing function where we are pairing two electrons. And here are the d orbitals. So this is an orbital index. And what we found is by diagonalizing this particle-particle amplitude matrix is that this matrix is very diagonal, which I don't understand exactly why, but it's very surprising. In terms of the k dependence, it's mostly cosine kx, cosine ky. So that basically means that the second nearest neighbor actually dominate the pairing. But the thing which was so interesting is that there are actually three different eigenvectors which can appear, and it has to do with the phases of these 3D orbitals, the xz, yz, xy, and xy. So let me explain this. So if you have the standard s plus minus, then the three orbitals have exactly the same phase. So these three numbers are all equal. Now, if we have the d wave stake, then one, the xz orbital has a 1, and the yz orbital has a minus 1. When you look at what this means from the point of view of symmetry, is that if you carry out a rotation in spin and orbital, then the order parameter gets an extra minus sign. Finally, there's a new antiphase state where the xzyz have 1, and the xy orbital has a minus 1. And we're doing calculations at high temperatures, and these three states are very, very close in energy. Now, is it possible that this antiphase orbital s plus minus actually exists? And I think I would like to suggest, without pushing this too much, that this is a plausible explanation to some experiments in lithium iron arsenide, which is the material has been best studied in photoemission. And the point is that what experimentalists measure is the angle dependence of the order parameter around the M point and around the gamma point. And in the standard S plus minus state, the experimentalist, a paper by Borisenko, noticed some discrepancies in the M point with the standard S plus minus theory, in the sense that the experimental points, which are here in this blue line, have a minimum, where the inner pocket has a maximum. And the S plus minus state has also a minimum rather than a maximum. And that's something that actually puzzled the experimentalist, but it's easily explained within this calculation. I should stress, this is a very high temperature calculation. We have not yet gone to the low temperature phase, but if you take the experimental seriously, then there is some, this is in reasonable agreement with experiment. Okay, so now the questions that we come to sort of the more material dependent questions, which I think they're actually the more interesting ones. And what we want to know is really what governs the strength of the correlations. And there are really two factors that are very important. One is the filling. And it's important to understand that the half-filled shell is very important. That's where the spin susceptibility becomes divergent. This is the spin susceptibility. While the orbital susceptibility is maximum around one unit away from the half-filled shell. That's where you have Hund's metal behavior. That's one factor. The other factor is basically the nictogen height. And this is a DMFT study across all the families where we actually elucidated how the correlations vary as you vary the nictogen height. And you see, starting here, this is sort of like a map, a material map, where you start here, you start with a very, very weak correlations in the iron phosphides. Then when you move to the 1111, you have intermediate correlations. And then when you get towards the iron selenides and the iron terurides, you have extremely strong correlations and you find that this XY orbital has a mass that begins to diverge. Now, why does the XY orbital diverge? Well, the XY orbital is special because there are two processes that contribute to the hopping of XY orbital. One is the direct hopping, which has a minus, and another one is an indirect hopping, which has a plus. And it turns out that the iron telluride is where these two processes more or less cancel. It's just words. You have to compare, actually, the spectral function.